When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the 305th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Ariel Winter, author of the new novel, The Preserve. Stay tuned for the interview. And stay tuned after the interview as Ariel Winter reads a short excerpt from his new novel, The Preserve. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen to audiobooks during your commute, while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from people who know audiobooks best, your local bookseller. Reading and Writing Podcast special offer. Get two audiobooks for the price of one with your first month of membership with code RWPODCAST. That's code RWPODCAST for two audiobooks for the price of one for your first month of membership at Libro.fm. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Ariel S. Winter, author of the new novel, The Preserve. Ariel's previous novels include Barren Cove and The 20-Year Death. Ariel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, if someone hasn't heard about your novel, The Preserve, yet, how would you describe the novel?
So it is set in a near future in which there has been a pandemic that has wiped out most of the human population, and the robots have become the primary life form on the planet. The preserve is something the robots have set up for the remaining humans so that they can live in a robot-free environment. And the book opens with the first murder taking place on the preserve.
And do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write The Preserve?
So there were a couple of things. One, my novel Barren Cove, the novel right before this, is also a robot book. And in that book, there's only one human and all the other characters are robots. So one of the things that led me to The Preserve was the idea of sort of reversing that, where it's all humans, even though it's still a robot world, and there's really only one robot character. So that was one aspect of it. And then the other was a desire to get back to writing a mystery. The 20-Year Death, my first book, is a mystery. Barren Cove is not. And so this was sort of a way to further explore the robot world in the vein of a mystery.
And what is it about the mystery form that appeals to you?
At the base, I'm just a big fan. I've been reading mysteries since I was a kid. I've always loved them. But I also think that the mystery gives you an opportunity to really ask some existential questions. First off, it is often really a matter of life or death. So that really forces the big questions. I just feel like it's a versatile medium to really approach anything in.
Well, you mentioned earlier about having this idea that kind of came out of writing your previous novel. I'm curious, what's the creative process for you? I mean, once you have that idea, when you sat down and started working on The Preserve, were you writing kind of organically and trying to figure out where the story was going to lead, or do you write a more formal kind of outline or synopsis before you begin the novel? What's your process?
Right. So I am the type of writer who just sort of writes blind and sees where it goes. So I had that initial idea of the preserve and the first murder happening. And then I just started writing and see where it goes. After the rough draft, you know, once I've made it all the way through the story once, then I sort of go back and form an outline from that and see where things need to move for pacing, or if, you know, I've repeated myself or, you know, anything to get the, you know, to in the rewrite process to get the story to its best form.
Sure. What are your earliest memories of writing fiction?
So I started writing in about fourth grade. I had to write a short story for school. I was already a huge reader. I just read, you know, like a book a day in elementary school. I was a huge reader. And so once they asked me to write at school, it right away became something that I was very excited about. And then I sort of never stopped.
And can you kind of talk about your writing journey that eventually led you to writing and getting your first novel published?
Sure.
From that, you know, fourth grade story.
Yeah, sure. So I won't belabor my younger years. It'll suffice to say that I wrote all through school. By the time I was going to college, I was 100% certain I wanted to be a writer. And so I actually majored in creative writing in college. So that was hugely formative for me, the workshops and classes and readings that I did throughout college. I wrote my first novel, which is not my first published novel, just the first novel that I wrote in college. And I wrote, I think as many people do, I have written or had written several novels before the 20-year death, none of which saw the light of day. The one thing that I like to tell people or point out about my journey is that I had several different agents before the 20-year death sold. Sometimes the first agent just isn't the right fit for you. It's a lot like dating. You got to try it out. So I had a few agents and they just weren't the right fit until I got my agent that was able to sell the 20-year death.
Well, I know that there are probably people listening who are kind of in that process. And I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit more. I mean, obviously without, you know, naming names specifically, but I wonder if you could just kind of delve a little bit more into why they weren't the right fit for you and how you kind of figured that out.
Sure. So my first agent, one of the frustrating things was that I didn't end up getting the attention that I wanted when I would try to reach out to my agent. I didn't always get a response back, and I was kept pretty in the dark about how many places my book had been sent and what the responses were like. It was sort of just a black hole with that first agent. And so eventually I just got very frustrated that I was getting no communication and ended up parting ways with that agent. The next agent I had was more communicative, but I think we really ended up having different visions for my book and my career. The 20-year death is set up as three separate novels that form a larger novel. And the first novel in the 20-year death, my agent at that time was very interested in pulling that out and having it be the first in a series about that particular detective. And at the time, I was not interested in writing a detective series, even though I liked working in mystery. The 20-year death was something different than that. So the relationship was fine. It just ended up being that we didn't really have the same vision. until I found my final agent, who was very communicative, extremely willing to go in whatever direction I wanted to go with my career, with my writing, and ultimately was able to actually sell the book for me.
And so you mentioned that first novel that was published, 20 Year Death, which was published by Hard Case Crime. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how it was working with Hard Case?
So Hard Case was always sort of where I wanted it to be. So it was really wonderful that it ended up being, you know, that I got my wish and that it ended up being there. Hard Case is published by Charles Ardai. He's the founder and the publisher and editor for The Line. And he is extremely smart and very good editor. He's a hands-on editor. You know, he really makes suggestions and he's just a wonderful person to work with. Fortunately also Hard Case really was excited about the book and they really did a lot of promotion for it and it got a good amount of attention.
So I'm curious, you mentioned these early novels and you said that they didn't see the light of day. Now that you have, The Preserve is your third novel that's been published. If you looked back now, why do you think that those early novels didn't see the light of day?
I mean, some of it has to do with just, I was not as good a writer then as I am now. I was young. I was still learning the novel form. So some of those really are, I guess, juvenilia in that sense. I have one novel that I still feel strongly about and hope to one day publish. And that actually did get a bunch of interest from several different editors at different publishers. And in the end, they just weren't able to make an offer. So that one is sitting on standby. So hopefully it'll come out someday.
And I'm curious with that, have you ever considered self-publishing? Because in this podcast, I interview both traditionally published, and I would say that probably if you looked at the ratio of interviews that I've done, which is over 300 at this point, that probably the ratio would be 85% traditionally published. But I'm curious, to me, it would seem like given the fact that you've had three novels published and that had interest, but didn't make it getting an offer, have you ever considered self-publishing? And if not, I'm curious why that doesn't appeal to you or why that's not of interest to you.
Yeah. I have not actually considered it. Part of it is when I was starting out, self-publishing has become much more popular and the stigma that it used to have is much less than it used to be. But I think that I still, I started before that shift. So the vision had always been to be published by a publisher. And I can also say, as somebody who has been published by a traditional publisher, doing it on my own seems daunting, I would say. It's very hard to get through the noise and have some promotion and some distribution. And that is what the traditional publisher brings.
Sure. Well, I know you wrote a blog, We Two Were Children, Mr. Barry, which is still accessible online, that dives really deep into children's book and children's literature. And I know you wrote a picture book, One of a Kind. Do you have plans to write more children's books or picture books?
I would love to write more picture books. And like with my novel, I have some picture books that I've written that did not sell. But the picture book market is really challenging. I mean, all book markets are challenging, but the picture book market is very challenging, in part because I think so many people feel like, oh, there's nothing to writing a picture book, and it's very short, and I can just do that, even though it's a lot more difficult than it looks. So I was sort of discouraged by my agent from pursuing it further simply because the market was so challenging and my adult fiction was getting noticed. So I've sort of put my children's writing on hold.
And what was it about children's literature that appealed to you in terms of the blog that you did write? And I should add, it's not as active today, but it's still there and accessible if someone is interested in taking a look at it. What was it about it that appealed to you in terms of writing this specific blog?
Sure. So people understand what the blog was about. It focused on authors that are generally thought of as adult authors who wrote picture books and you just never even knew, or sometimes young novels, and you just never knew that they did that. People like Graham Greene wrote picture books. Patricia Highsmith wrote a picture book. Chinua Achebe wrote a bunch of picture books. And so these are people who are, of course, revered for their adult work. And often their children's work is not even known. I sort of, over the years, developed a list of these people where I would notice in their bibliographies, taking a deeper look at their bibliographies, that they had this out-of-print children's book. And I just started to get really curious about that. I was a children's bookseller for a while. So children's books were my sort of professional focus as well. And so between the two, the sort of just bibliophile interest in these sort of literary peculiarities and my work, my day job at the time as being a children's bookseller, I wanted to bring a lot of those to light.
Interesting. So what writing advice would you offer for those who are writing their own stories and novels?
So I don't think that I have anything that you probably haven't heard before. Obviously, the biggest one is to just do it. Write every day. Just carve out some protected time, if possible, to practice and write every single day. Then, of course, the other side of it is reading as much as you possibly can, reading the kinds of books that you are interested in writing to learn from those who have come before. I know that's not unusual advice, but really reading a lot and writing a lot is the only way to get there.
Gotcha. So are you working on another novel now?
I am working on one. Until it's done, I generally don't share what it's about, but I will say that it's another crime novel.
Got it. So what fiction or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
So I just read Susanna Clarke's new book, Piranesi, and it was incredible. I highly recommend it. At the beginning, it's a very odd book, and I wasn't sure that I was getting into it. And then it just sort of kicks in, and it was very hard to put down. So I'm sure a lot of people already have that on their list, but Piranesi is excellent. The other thing I'm reading right now, I got the Library of America's Women Crime Writers box set. Which is 8 novels by women crime writers from the 1940s and 1950s. So I'm working my way through that and really enjoying that as well. I love, as anyone who read The 20-Year Death would know, I love hard-boiled fiction. I love that era of the crime fiction from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. And it's interesting to get to see some women writers because they're not as well-known as some of the male contemporaries.
That's great. I love the Library of America. Where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you and your novels?
Right. So I still, like you said, I still like people to go to the blog, We Two Were Children, Mr. Barry. I don't update it often, but it does link to my novels. Otherwise, I have a Facebook page, author page, and that's where I update things that are happening with my career and upcoming events and that kind of thing.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Ariel S. Winter, author of the new novel, The Preserve. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Ariel, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you for having me.
And now listen as Ariel Winter reads an excerpt from his new novel, The Preserve.
Sitting down, Chief of Police Jesse Loughton put his palms on his desk to steady himself, closed his eyes, and took a deep breath. He was exhausted. His headache, coupled with the chronic pain in his face, made it hard to focus. Life would be easier if I was dead, he thought, then opened his eyes and looked at the clock on the wall without turning his head. The thin red hand made its stuttering march through the numbers into the late afternoon, only 43 minutes left in his shift. Then the phone on his desk buzzed, the vibration sliding it across the out-of-date calendar blotter. He had it set on Do Not Disturb and lying face down. He knew that having his phone in Do Not Disturb mode during his shift was not only against the police department's bylaws, but as chief was irresponsible. But this late in the day, he just didn't care. Now it was ringing anyway, which meant that somebody needed to get through badly enough to call him more than once in 2 minutes. Still, he watched it buzz for another few seconds before working up the strength to turn it over to see who was calling. It was Matthews. That was bad. He answered, Chief Loughton. Well, we won the lottery, Matthews said without a hello. Loughton felt his stomach drop, followed by a wave of nausea. He waited for it. Dead body, Matthews said, taser to the neck. Loughton closed his eyes again. Homicide. Looks like it. First one on the preserve. Shit. 9 months since they opened the Socar Preserve and the first body had shown up in Liberty. Really, it's amazing it took this long. The drop in violent crime since the preserve opened was something both the robot and preserve governments were touting as proof that the preserve had been a success that far exceeded expectations. Well, the honeymoon was over. It's Carl Smythe. Body was behind Kramer's Market between the dumpster and the loading dock. I thought you'd want to come look. Chief Loughton could feel his left lower eyelid fluttering. The whole left side of his face began to tingle. Chief? Anything I can't get from the pictures, he said. It's just when they start asking questions, Matthews said, they're going to be asking you. Why did it have to be in Liberty? Okay, Loughton said, I'll be right over. We'll be waiting. Chief Loughton hung up and held the phone a moment in a daze. He looked at the clock again. It promised 37 minutes left in his shift, but that didn't mean anything now. If only his head didn't hurt. He opened his desk drawer and took out a bottle of Advil. Each pill cost a fortune these days, but if there was ever a time to use them, this was it, even if he knew they probably wouldn't help. He swallowed 4, dry, dropped the bottle back in his desk drawer, and looked at his gun sitting in the drawer as well. The way his face felt, he couldn't shoot straight if he had to. There was no reason to make the first murder in preserve history, also the first day he carried a gun since coming to Liberty. He slammed the drawer shut, stood, and strode out of the room.